Good day, Internet.
Good day, Internet.
Good day. Good day, Nicole Lee.
Good day.
Hello. Happy Monday, everybody. This is only one of two Daily Tech News shows that I'll be doing this week because I'm off. I'm off to celebrate my 20th wedding anniversary in South Korea. Probably just south. I don't think I'll go north.
No. That's probably wise.
Sounds like I mean,
let's just do the show then. All right, here we go. In three, two. This 10th year of Daily Tech News Show is made possible by you, the listener. Thanks to all of you, including Chris Allen, Chris Smith, and Mark Gibson. On this episode of DTNS, Dolby wants to make your TV speakers sound good without having to change anything or get a soundbar or nothing. The Verge reports on Google's note-taking large language model and why the problem with AI is scale. This is the Daily Tech News for Monday, August 28th, 2023 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
From San Francisco, I'm Nicole Lee.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Check.
Hey, did you hear OpenAI just launched its enterprise version of ChatGPT? That adds you more data analysis, privacy features, things like that for your big enterprise-level business. Let's see what else is in the quick hits. More than 500 flights were canceled and even more delayed because of a network-wide computer failure in the UK's air traffic control system. The problem affected the system's ability to automatically process flight plans, meaning all flight plans had to be processed manually, which, as you can imagine, is a lot slower. That severely limited the number of flights that could be authorized for takeoff. The UK's National Airspace Controller, NATS, said it identified and remedied the fault after about 4 hours, but still, pretty widespread effects there. Lots of credible Apple leaks out there today. None of them terribly surprising. We're going to get new iPhones next month. Wow. Likely on September 12th. That all tracks. iPhone might get USB-C, which would be new, but also not that surprising given the EU laws coming. The least expected leak comes from Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, who says an overhauled iPad Pro is in the works for 2024, which would be the biggest update to the iPad since 2018. He's hearing it would be the first iPad with an OLED display at 11 and 13 inches. Might be a new Magic Keyboard that would add a larger trackpad if you want the iPad Pro to act more like a laptop. And of course, an M3 chip. Expect iPads to be announced as they usually are in a separate event from new iPhones. So we'll probably get new iPhones in September. And if we get new iPads, those will come in October. DoorDash will offer a product with some language and voice processing so that restaurants can have a machine take phone orders without making employees answer the phones. They found like something like 50% of phone orders get lost because people just don't answer the phone at the restaurant. They're too busy. The service will include humans who can jump in if the automated system runs into trouble with an order, but not the humans in the restaurant, like part of the service. And of course, it can plug into DoorDash Drive, which is the company's white label direct delivery product that lets a restaurant manage its own delivery process. Tech News Taiwan reports that Asus may have shut down its Zenfone division as part of a reorganization. Now, that reorg did not appear to affect the gaming phone team, so we'll still have our ROG phones. You just won't get the Zenfone. Zenfones are loved for having flagship specs in a more compact form factor. And finally, WA Beta Info reports that the latest Android beta of WhatsApp lets you select original quality photos or videos, no compression. WA Beta Info's screenshot shows choose from gallery as an option in the document picker and specifically mentions the ability to send original quality photos and videos. This is different than the option to send HD photos through WhatsApp, which launched last month, but still compresses the image. And that's a look at the quick hits. All right, let's talk about this new Dolby feature. It's for Atmos, Dolby Atmos, called Flex Connect, that lets you use accessory wireless speakers along with your TV's built-in speaker to make your home theater sound better. That way you can put speakers anywhere in the room you want to. You don't have to position them just right. And they will work well with your TV's built-in speakers, so you don't need to buy a separate soundbar. Dolby uses the TV's built-in microphone to locate and calibrate each wireless speaker, and they think they've got their algorithm tuned, so it doesn't matter what speakers you have and where, they can make it sound the best that those speakers are capable of. It will know the relative capabilities of each speaker, for example, so if your wireless speakers are better at bass than your TV, then it'll push more of the bass out to the wireless speakers. This is similar to Samsung's Q Symphony, does a similar thing. Sony's Acoustic Center Sync also does something like this. Dolby is demonstrating this at IFA in Berlin this week and says it will ship in TCL TVs and wireless speakers next year. Nicole, I know you're not like a big expert audiophile or anything, but you know, how does this strike your fancy for a home theater setup?
The thing that pops out to me the first and foremost is that this does require getting a new TV. Because it sounds like the Dolby Flex Connect technology anyway only applies to newer TVs. Like TCL, as you mentioned, would be the one of the first TV manufacturers to come with technology. But I don't know about you, but I don't get a new TV every few years. I just have to still have the same old TV that I've had for the last few years. So me personally, I would prefer it if just all TVs have this technology versus, you know, some of the new ones. But for me, I'll just get a soundbar because I'm not changing out my TV, which, you know, it still works fine the way it is. So I don't know. I think this definitely probably more appeals to the people who are shopping for a new TV. But even then, I wonder about the flexibility of such a technology and sort of the benefit of a separate AV system is that you can swap out your soundbar or your speakers or whatever as technology improves. And I mean, maybe they'll be able to like have a little firmware update. Maybe Flex Connect will get better in the future, but I don't know.
Well, that's the idea with Dolby is that hopefully more than just TCL puts this in, more TVs come with it. And as you buy a new TV, it comes with it. And maybe it's cheaper than buying a soundbar to just get a couple of wireless speakers. I think, Roger, where I start to wonder is how many devices is this going to be in? Even if it gets in a lot of TVs, you also have to have it in the speakers.
And I think that those are two really good questions to raise because, you know, as we all know, you can't adopt a product if there's not enough manufacturers, and manufacturers might not introduce a product if they don't see enough people using. So it's a chicken and egg thing. But what this does, at least in my eyes, is it does sort of standardize this sort of technology, which is was mentioned in the read. Samsung and Sony have both introduced respectively on their own platforms. It does free up people to say, hey, maybe I don't want a Samsung speaker or I don't want to be tied to Sony's acoustic center sync system. And this allows a little more flexibility. The truth of the matter is, you know, 80% of the people are fine with the TV they have and they're fine with the sound that their TV produces. And when you get into nicher, you know, as you get into a higher element of people who want to select and pick and match products, they tend to either do things, as Nicole says, is I'll just get an AV receiver that supports all the formats, plug my TV into it, you know, and then I can move my speakers and get whatever I want. Requires a lot of separate, you know, picking and choosing and buying and cobbling together, which I've done, and then I just sold like last year because it got a little too much. This allows kind of a halfway in between getting a soundbar or the simplicity of just buying a soundbar and having the audio and then having something a little more expansive without being so complicated where you have to worry about, well, you know, I can buy from 100 different loudspeaker manufacturers or I can go to Best Buy and select from these five and say, hey, this fits my room. Perfect. I don't have to figure out where the sound's going to get adjusted. Like I have an old Denon, you know, from 12 years ago that had the microphone in the center of the room and will auto adjust everything for you. But it was so kludgy. And this promises
well, 10 years ago,
little,
right?
Yeah.
That's old. But,
well, exactly. But this promises not only to take that and make it more simple, but it also offers a standardized or industry standard that everyone could adhere to and not have to worry, well, this is incompatible.
Well, it's not an industry standard. It's Dolby's proprietary thing. But
it's true.
To your point, Dolby's not trying to keep it in their Dolby branded speakers. They're willing to license it out.
Exactly.
They're good at that. Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that this could show up in more products. And I think that percentage of people who are not home theater aficionados who want to max out quality but do want something probably is bigger than we think, because I think a lot of those people show up at the store and say, that looks too complicated. Even a soundbar and two, you know, like a 2.1 system, they're like, wait, I have to put that on, mount that on the wall. I don't want to do that. I don't want to mess with that. So being able to say like, hey, if you buy this TV, if you want a little more surround sound, you can just buy those two speakers over there and they're less expensive than the big soundbar system. Maybe you end up expanding this. It's just a matter of getting it into more products, which is what Dolby wants to do. And Dolby's good at that, so maybe it will. Verge's David Pierce has an article up called Google's AI-powered note-taking app is the messy beginning of something great. It's a look at Google's Notebook LM. That's the one they announced at Google I.O. in May. You might remember they announced it as Project Tailwind, but they very quickly changed it to be called Notebook LM. It trains off your own notes. So if you remember us talking about it, we liked it because it was a limited data set. This isn't train off the entire web. This is an algorithm that has been trained to be a large language model that then trains specifically on your things and gives you specific answers related to your own research. So Pierce does an excellent job, of course, at explaining his experience. I encourage you to read that full article. But a few items from it stood out to us. It only accepts imports from Google Docs right now. There are more sources to come, but it is a little limited right now, and it is in beta. For now, each source can only be up to 10,000 words, and a project can only use 5 sources. So again, maybe it'll expand, but right now in the beta, it's a little limited. It generates things like outlines, lists of topics, and even comes up with questions you can ask it. Answers to any questions, whether the ones it suggests or not, come with citations from your source material. And Pierce said, it does a really good job of identifying the bits of information that are relevant to my question. In fact, he, and apparently a lot of people that use this, really valued that more than the actual answers it gave. He was like, yeah, the answers were all right. Not anything maybe I couldn't have come up with my own, but the citations really revealed some things about my source material that I might not have seen otherwise. It also added info one time that was not in Pierce's sources. So he asked Google about that and they said, yeah, the model has the capability to bring in other information, and they're trying to work out what the line is there because they know that in some cases it might be helpful. In fact, in the case with Pierce, apparently it was helpful, but they want to make sure that people know when it's doing that, have some control over when it's doing that, maybe turn it off, turn it on, et cetera. And they're still trying to work out where that line is. Nicole, what do you think of Notebook LM based on this?
Honestly, as I was reading this from a purely sort of a selfish perspective, I can see this being a hugely helpful for a lot of journalists out there. And the reason is because I remember when I was doing a lot of reporting back in the day, I would interview, like, let's say 3 to 4 different sources for a piece, and I would have to transcribe all of those interviews, right? So those transcripts can be literally thousands of words long per transcript. Can you imagine? I just imagine just spitting that into this software, Notebook LM, and it would just like do a little summary, do a little maybe pulling out relevant quotes from that transcript, and it would probably might be really useful in me doing sort of putting my story together. And not just for journalists, I'm sure like research papers in college or any kind of work and profession that you would use research in. And I think it's just so, it makes things that you would normally do already, but it will make it so much quicker and so much more efficient than you just doing it yourself, you know?
Yeah, Roger, you were saying you thought it might be really helpful in educational settings.
Actually, now that I think about it, it helps in a couple of ways. One, I was saying, like, studying. I knew someone who was going to law school, and they just had not just binders, they had several binders full of notes. And, you know, as you study for, you know, whether it's an LSAT or whatever test you're taking, you know, you often have copious amounts of notes. And I can honestly say sometimes it's really hard to keep track of what's what and what's where. Having everything not just only condensed but also parsed and being searchable and have an AI to kind of help
searchable
you sort
and
all that.
Interpretable, right? It's not just dumb search, but it's a search that actually knows, like, oh, these are the kinds of things you're talking about. I find that compelling.
And yeah, that was this. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
There was this
part in the
story that you said that the notebook software was able to pull out that, for example, speed was a crucial advantage of the story that he was researching because someone else, the author of one of the papers, wrote it. Because he quoted a bunch of executives saying that speed was a key factor of spreadsheets. So even though he didn't come up with it, the fact that he quoted a bunch of people in the story that mentioned it was a key sort of an analytic factor from the story.
I mean, it also, if you're working on a PhD and you're doing your dissertation and you have volumes and volumes of notes from your research, from, you know, other pieces of study, this really does help. If you're an author, if you're writing a book, I know, you know, a friend of the show, Annalee Newitz, whenever she comes with a, you know, she's writing a new book, she has a lot of notes she pulls information from. How awesome would it be to just have that instead of like, oh, where did I write it? What did I write? And when did I write it? And how does it relate to this other aspect of, say, something like archaeology or history? This is like the assistant you would hire in many ways to help you sort through all the stuff.
Yeah, didn't Pierce call it something like people at Google are calling it a team of infinite interns or something? Yes. Like that. Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, I would totally use this just to help sort out my life because I have so many things that could. It's weird because I see this.
I immediately thought of when you had to go through probate on a house.
Still going through it.
Right. And this kind of thing is like, you need to have a lot of information collected in one place, be able to make it easily interpretable. This sort of thing can be really helpful. And it was interesting that Pierce noted that the Google folks just call it Notebook, not Notebook LM. And I have a feeling that whether that's subconscious or intentional, that they look at this as a notebook product. Like, instead of using Notepad, use Notebook so that it can take your notes and expand them. And obviously, at some point, it's going to have to go beyond five sources. It's going to have to go beyond Google Docs, but it would be able to take your notes and make sense of them. I think that's pretty interesting. This could be the first big AI product for Google. Not search. Search has got its own path that it's on, and I'm sure it'll be interesting, but this feels more useful to me.
And, if they can offer assurances to potential customers about, you know, privacy, about, like, whatever you stick in there stays within the confines to that account, I think they have a winner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, I taught a course recently. It was just a 90-minute seminar, really, on how to make a great podcast. And if you weren't able to be part of that, we did have to limit the number of seats. We have it available at the Patreon store, Daily Tech News Show, patreon.com/DTNS/shop. So if you want to get a streamable or a downloadable version, I explain the foundational elements of podcast producing. I share ideas, my experiences on making a podcast great, how we do our rundowns, things like that. So you can get that class again as a downloadable audio file or a streaming video. It depends on your preference. You can get it either way, same price for either one. And you can find that at patreon.com/DTNS. Longtime tech reporter and analyst Benedict Evans has a post up that got kind of buzzy today. It's up there, you know, towards the top half of Tech Meme. Tech Meme described it as a look at the ethical and legal issues around generative AI, which makes things that were previously only possible on a small scale practical at a massive scale. And the scale really is the essential part of this. It's a great article. Of course, I encourage you to read the whole thing. We'll have it linked in the show notes. But for now, I want to focus on this paragraph. Evans wrote, "A person can listen to 1,000 hours of music and make something in that style. If a person did that, they wouldn't have to pay a fee to all those artists. So if we use a computer for that, do we need to pay them? I don't think we know how we think about that. We might know what the law might say, but we might want to change that." And then this question Evan puts forward later on, I think, really brings that issue into focus. AI makes practical at a massive scale things that were previously only possible on a small scale. A difference in scale can be a difference in principle. What outcomes do we want? What do we want the law to be? What can it be? I think this is so well put. This is the difference between saying, hey, 5 or 6 friends, let's meet up at a bar, and putting a notice on Facebook if you're like a hugely influential Facebook poster and having thousands of people show up at the bar. One's totally fine. The bar loves it. Nobody cares. The other is a problem that you need to plan for and treat differently. Scale makes all the difference. We obviously see that with email and spam. And I think Evans very clearly puts forward that the problem with AI is that you can't just make an allegory to what we do. You have to look at the scale as well. Nicole, what do you think of this?
I think there's an interesting point he made in the article about Taylor Swift. And whether you can make it like the, you know, saying if you tell an AI, hey, make this song in the style of Taylor Swift, that's one thing, right? But if you tell the AI, hey, make a song based on the past 10 years of pop music, mm-hmm. it might mention Taylor Swift. It might sort of like pull some of Taylor Swift because it's, you know, she's part of the past 10 years of pop music. But it's not specifically about her. It's just like a generalized sample. The 10 past years of pop music. So if that's the case, do they have to pay royalties to the artists of the past 10 right. years?
Yeah.
You know, like how extensive do you want to give that kind of a thing? And I do agree that like a person might be able to do it. Like a person might be able to sample, you know, some music of the past 10 years, but a person doing it doesn't have as much. So if let's say a person does it, they're just sampling music. You could argue that, right? They're not pulling from a specific person, let's say. But yeah, I do think the laws have to be different because it is different. AI is not the same thing as a person. And, you know, yeah, I do think that's true.
Yeah, and I think he does a great job of explaining in this article that the data that it trained on is not in the model. So when you ask it to do it in the style of Taylor Swift, it doesn't look in its database at Taylor Swift songs. It's just in the model to know what that means and output things. So it's not the same as copying. It used copies to train on, but it doesn't keep the copies of them. So it's a whole different question than copyright at that point. And I think the scale is the place to get at it because, like you said, you could say, make a song in the style of the last 10 years of pop music. Who do you owe that to? If you say Taylor Swift, it's easy. Oh, okay. If we decide that you should owe anything, we know who to pay it to. Although with Taylor Swift, which one are you copying? Taylor's version or the one owned by her original label? Those are two different royalty holders. Like, so it does start to get complicated there. But what if it is multiple things? What if you have changed it, the parameters? At what point do you owe any compensation to people? And what point do you not? Is it just being trained? I'll throw my opinion out. And Roger and Nicole, you guys can bet this around. I think we need to create a very small royalty mechanism similar to what we do for songwriters. There's something called a mechanical royalty that says you don't have to get the songwriter's permission, but if you cover their song and you release it, you owe a fixed royalty to the songwriter. I think we should do something like that for training data. And I think it needs to be smaller than the royalty because training data is infinitesimally small in its inclusion in the model. If you remove one song from the training data, it doesn't materially change the model. So it needs to be a smaller rate, but I think there should be a mechanical rate set for if you're in the training data, you're not really being copied, but let's give you something for the privilege of them using your data to create their model.
I think for me as well, the question comes to what does the person using the AI, like what are they using the final result for? Like, are they using the sample to release actual music that they're selling? Are they using the result of the art that they create through the AI? Are they like selling it through commercial means? Is it kind of an educational thing? So that's definitely part of it, right? Like, so I do agree that if it's a commercial use of some kind, I do think some kind of royalty somewhere needs to be put in place. Otherwise,
you think, you know, the whole thing is going to... Because I was saying the creator of the model should have to pay a bit of a royalty. You're thinking the user of the model also might need to pay something if they're selling something. I think that starts to get tricky, though.
I don't know.
I mean, if you're like very clearly copying, you know, Suga of BTS, then yeah, you're gonna owe something to them. But if you're doing something that's a little, you know, less identifiable, I don't know. Roger, what do you think?
I mean, it's one of those things where there are so many instances where you can think of, well, they should be compensated for this, should be compensated for that. I think there's merit to both you, to yours and Nicole's suggestion in that a mechanical license, but I'm wondering if that just applies to to anyone who picks up this data, like you have to use this particular set of data, for example.
Well, there could be data that's in the public domain, just like there's intellectual.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Like, domain. Is there a limit? Is there a lifetime to this?
That's a good question.
My question is, if you sample it not on the past 20 years, but everything pre 1900s, and you use that as your training model, and it generates works from that. Would we have the same?
No, because those are public domain. Yeah, I do think it would. Yeah. No, this is a good clarifying question. Is I do think it that royalty would have to apply to things that are protected already, not things that are unprotected.
Yeah. Because you know it's so complicated, and I do think that might be one way to deal with it. But at the same time, I agree with Nicole. It's like, the user, you know, whoever uses, like when you use stock images, you use stock samples or whatever, you pay a small fee for it that covers the license and the royalty for all the stuff that you use. So you don't have to worry about it from that point forward. And I think that, you know, that you pay to play. So if you use it in a work, whether it's a game, it's a novel,
again, go back to our earlier conversation. Those are more clear, but what if you're just using the training data to create something that's the last 10 years of images? Do they get nothing for that?
Like, I mean,
that's the problem that becomes trickier. Is like, it's not about, I think current law can deal with, I created something that's exactly the same. I think when it starts to become like, well, it's in the style of, or it's kind of like, that's where it gets trickier.
I guess based on that stock image example, it would be like not a real person, but like an AI generated.
Yeah, like, and not a copy, but something that kind of looks like that.
Make this photo look like Van Gogh.
Right, exactly.
The style of Van Gogh.
Is there something right now that's fine? If it's in the style of Van Gogh, you don't own any. Well, Van Gogh is a bad example because he's public domain. But if it's in the style of Scott Johnson, you don't own Scott Johnson. Yeah. You own Scott Johnson anyway. But when you can do Scott Johnson at the kind of scale that machine learning does, maybe we do need a different mechanism. But Scott would agree, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Well, folks, I'd love to hear, what would you do if you were the person in charge of setting policy? What would you recommend? Feedback at dailytechnewsshow.com. All right. One last story here that I think is really interesting. You might know that magnetic tape storage is not just a cool retro thing Gen Z uses to play old music. Oh, no. It has consistently provided a compact way for large organizations to make long-term backups for a long time. Something you don't need to access fast. You just want it reliably stored. They call it cold storage. And it's still being developed. IBM just announced its new TS1170 drive that can store 50 terabytes uncompressed on one cartridge and up to 150 terabytes if you compress it. And that's a big jump. The previous model, the TS1160, could only do 20 terabytes uncompressed. So I know for some of you, you might not have realized that magnetic tape storage was still a thing, which it absolutely is. And for those of you who do know and work with this, hey, you've got a brand new IBM product that's going to increase the ability to store stuff. They're still developing it.
Tape is always one of the recommended long-term storage formats for a large database. I mean, not talking about your home, you know, 2 terabyte NAS.
No, this is for companies. Yeah. try to get one. It's a little expensive, though.
Even medium-sized companies, say if you're like an internet-facing company that deals with a lot of online clientele, you got to store that data. And sure, maybe only a few years doesn't add up to much, but once you start going into 5, 10, 15, that's a lot of stuff you got to keep track of.
Yeah. I say it's expensive for the individual, but for an enterprise, it's actually quite affordable. All right, let's check out the mailbag. TJ Asher liked our discussion on the extended show on Friday about whether it's better to see the movie first or read the book first. TJ wrote, I have always been and still am in the camp of movie or TV show first. The book is always better because it can explore more and go into more detail than a movie. Take Jurassic Park, a movie which holds a special place in my heart. The movie was amazing, but the entire subplot of the industrial espionage and morality of genetic engineering was represented by one silly scene and a single line of dialogue by Jeff Goldblum. The exception that proves the rule is Song of Ice and Fire. The books are so ridiculously drawn out and overly detailed that the synopsis of the TV show was superior for a good portion of the story, season 8 excluded. Looking forward to the next Friday quiz or debate. Thank you, TJ. You threw George R. R. Martin under the bus there at the end, though.
Oh, gosh.
You don't like the several pages on lemon tarts? I find that refreshing and delectable. I really do, actually. I really like George R. R. Martin's writing. I would say you still want to see the TV show first and then read the books. Some of the books still need to be written. I understand that. But the ones that are, I think that's infinitely preferable. Well, Nicole, first of all, where do you stand? Book or movie first?
I would say book first, if you can swing it. But I don't. I'm not a hardline. If you want to watch a movie first, that's fine. I'm not against it.
Well, don't hold that against Nicole either. And go enjoy her other fine works. Where can they go, Nicole?
The easiest way to do is just go to my Linktree, username Nicole Nerd.
Excellent. Patrons, stick around for the extended show Good Day Internet. Dear Abby, the venerable newspaper advice column is still around and handled the question this week of whether you have to get a smartphone in this day and age or whether companies should just remember there are folks out there with their $30 feature phones. The answer may surprise you. You can also catch the show live Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 2000 UTC. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. Sarah Lane and I are back tomorrow with more tech news. Please join us then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
An excellent show. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
So let's talk Dear Abby.
Dear Abby.
I woke up this morning, I would not have guessed that I was going to be talking about Dear Abby. But Dear Abby's still a thing. I had to look up why. It began in 1956. Abigail is a nom de plume for Pauline Phillips, who originated the column. And it is still written today by her daughter, Jean Phillips. Oh. So it's all in the family. Today's Dear Abby column was high up on the Google News tech algorithm. That's how I noticed it. Here was the first part of the question. It actually went on for a while. But the first part of the question was, can people in this society please stop assuming that everyone has a smartphone? Not everyone is willing or able to spend $1,000 plus for one. Some of us carry older, less expensive phones that receive calls and text messages, and that's it. Now, it goes on from there for several paragraphs, venting frustration, giving anecdotes about, you know, doctor's offices and customer service representatives assuming that the writer has a smartphone, made it clear that this was a person's on behalf of their mother trying to do things. So I thought Abby's response would be something like, yes, okay, here's how to deal with those customer service reps to kind of explain to them politely what's going on. But no, Abby's response was, first of all, to be sympathetic. That's very Dear Abby to the frustrations of the writer. But the last sentence was, because this is going to happen more and more frequently, for your own sake as well as your mother's, it's time to start seriously considering upgrading one or more of your devices. Even Dear Abby's like, just get a smartphone. You don't have to spend $1,000. You can get one for a couple hundred. Go down to your carrier, find an A50 from Samsung or something.
You can get a really inexpensive one.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be the top of the line flagship phone, right? I was. Does this surprise you that Dear Abby's like, just upgrade to a smartphone. Get with the times.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me, I suppose, because it is easier to... to just get a smartphone. I remember my mom was asked me a while ago, like, which phone should I get? Because she was torn between like an Android phone or like an iPhone. And I was very much of the opinion that get the phone that you're already used to. Mm. If you've been using an iPhone for the past how many years, get that.
Stick with it.
Because it's just stick with it. Because I don't know if you're patient enough to learn a whole new thing, get a whole new thing.
So, like, so she had already been using an iPhone, is what you're saying.
Yeah, if she's already been using an iPhone, I was just like, yeah, the other one might look cooler and they might be less expensive. But if you're used to one thing, I think you just get it. Because I didn't want to be tech support to my mom. So that's first of all. Second of all, I just think it would just be easier for her to just use the thing she already has, use the apps she already knows. But that's just me. In terms of, I don't know, I have in-laws. My mother-in-law is way more tech-savvy than my father-in-law. My mother-in-law has an iPhone, like a sort of, not the new one, but sort of like an older iPhone.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's really into it. My father-in-law, I think we tried to give him a phone once, and he would just forget it. He wouldn't charge it.
Oh, really?
He would just, like, leave it at home. And eventually we were like, you know what? It's fine. Forget about it.
I don't mean to sound indelicate, but age range for your father-in-law. What's the range we're talking about here?
Oh, I would say 70s, 80s.
Yeah, okay.
Something like that.
Because to me, that's a different situation. There's so many things when you get to that age, and I'm going to just talk about myself. When I get to that age, there's going to be things that I'm going to be like, I'm sorry, my brain just isn't plastic enough. I'm not going to be able to do that. That to me is an assistive living question versus a Dear Abby's talking to the child of the person here, not the mother, right? The child's trying to help the mother and complaining. Because I think it is legitimate for someone to be like, I'm 80 years old. I need some help if I'm going to have to do this. Now, hopefully when I'm 80 years old, I am one of the 80-year-olds who can do it, because there's plenty of you that can. I get that. But there are some times where you're just like, you know what? It's just not going to work for me. And that to me is a separate issue than in general. This kind of shone the light on me that it's a bit of a life skill to be able to use a smartphone now. Like, it's just a thing. It's like driving a car or having electricity in your house, or, you know, like, it's just becoming part of modern life.
I think, you know, for example, when, COVID restrictions, I know whenever I go to a doctor's office or a dentist's office, they text me a link that I would have to, like, fill out a form, like a, mm-hmm. like a permission form kind
yeah,
of.
Like, yeah.
Oh, have you been in contact with...
Right,
the COVID
right.
for the past 10 days or whatever. So that's a link that they send you
mm-hmm.
to a website that you have to fill out.
Yeah.
So, and if you have like a normal phone, you might not get a link to a website that you have to fill out.
Yeah.
You know? So
I feel like
I totally get it.
As soon as I said driving a car, I knew someone was going to jump on me, and Nick with a C already did. I meant that. It's a common skill. We don't look at driving a car as something like, whoa, you're trying to make someone learn to drive a car. Granted, I know not everybody learns to drive a car. To my point, I think a smartphone has become a more essential part of life than learning how to drive a car, because pretty much everyone benefits from learning how to use a smartphone, and it's easier and less dangerous than learning to drive a car. To me, it's more like learning how to write a check. Learning how to balance a checkbook.
Oh.
Like it's a skill like that.
It goes back to what I said a while ago, that there needs to be a smartphone with a much simplified interface for folks, and not even age specific, because my dad's like 86 and I'm tech support every week on his phone for that.
Exactly.
But where it's just like, this is your banking, this is your internet, this is what, you know, these are the buttons you can only press and never press anything else, right? Kind of lock it down to the things that they need to get done. Because right now, when I think about it, like, for me, a smartphone isn't an obstacle, but when I think about my dad, it's like, yeah, this other app, this banking app, this other banking app that looks very similar. They all have not wildly different, but you know, different enough interfaces that they don't necessarily translate from one to another.
I think that's fair to say. Like, there needs to be some kind of assistive device, again, along the lines of large print books, right? You know, or having materials available that are easier to read for people or in the language that they speak. Yeah, I think it's good to have more than just the, what was it, the jitterbug? Was that that old phone that was like...
It's interesting you mentioned that. Buttons. And, you know, some smartphones, lots of smartphones do have like assistive features,
yeah,
but they're kind of optional,
right?
You have to go in there and enable, like, toggle it. So I think it would be good to have like an in-between device, like a smartphone with those assistive features already, like, by default already
making it easy.
There.
Yeah, the iPhone has amazing assistive technologies. And frankly, the Android phones have made great strides in assistive technologies. Yeah. Again, we're not just talking about for older users, but across the board.
Anyone.
But you have to turn them on. You have to know. You have to learn what they are and how to turn them on. And granted, you go to an Apple store, they would help you with it. Like there's a method for that. But I like what you're saying, Nicole. Of like, what if you just sold one that's default ready? Like, oh, you're 80 plus user here. This has got the 80 plus user interface already installed and ready to go.
Yeah. Or it's a switch. You just go in the settings and you put my dad mode and you
when you set it up, right?
Yeah.
And it stays that way, right? It doesn't get changed when it's in his pocket because, you know, the icons are moving around or anything like that. I think, it's not even age thing. I don't even think it's a failure.
It's not just an age thing. You're right. You're absolutely right.
I think it's just a demographic or a part of the market that hasn't been addressed.
Well, obviously, right? The person writing this letter isn't the mother. It's the child who's like, I don't want to have to use a smartphone.
In fact,
it makes me wonder now if the mother's like, I want a smartphone. Why won't my son buy me the smartphone?
Because the son understands Nicole and my thing. We don't want to deal with tech support. I don't want to have to be on the phone and then fix their phone while they're talking on it.
That's Roger speaks from experience there, I have to say.
I have a friend who's, in her 30s and she's like, I have a feature phone because that's all I want to deal with.
Yeah.
Because I take phone calls. You want to leave a voice message? Leave a voice message. I can take text.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And if you have a computer with a web browser at home, then you can do a lot of those things that people are talking about in this Dear Abby of doing on phones. You can do them on a computer. You can do them on a tablet. You can do them in other ways. But it is easier to have a phone, even if it's just a very simple phone with a browser. And
you mentioned like that. I think the reason why the feature phone thing is kind of like looked down upon and stuff like that is because they are kind of crappy and they don't have the capabilities of a smartphone. Like the apps that they have on there are very rudimentary. Mm-hmm. It was harder to use an app on a feature phone than it is on a smartphone because the apps are so clunky and slow.
I don't even think the cost is the issue. Like if it was $1,000 and then my dad wouldn't have to bug me all the time, I would gladly pay it.
Worth it. But Roger's worth every cent.
But I do think, there, even when I sometimes, when icons get swapped out or they get updated and, the company thinks like, hey, we made a fresh new icon to show you that we've made, feature advancements in our app. And it's like, well, my dad says like, what happened to the app? I can't find it anymore. Staring at him in the face. Those are the kinds of user considerations, I think, when you're dealing with, not even a generational thing. It's just some people don't glom onto those things as quickly as other people want to.
But it is becoming an essential to life. Yeah. Like we are, I would have been shocked at how much it has become part of life if you would have told me 20 years ago that that's the way it was going to be. Because back then technology was a thing that we all did, but nobody else really understood. Now everyone has a smartphone. Everyone has apps. There are parts of technology that not everybody gets into, but everybody kind of understands the basics now. And do we think that's a problem that we have started to build society around? Like, well, you need to have a device to operate in a lot of areas.
I don't think it's a problem, but I think there needs to be an understanding that You know, when electricity was, you know, even in the 80s, electricity wasn't in every corner of the U.S. and there were parts where, sure, like, I have to go down. You know, you took those things into consideration the same way that not everyone had a touch tone telephone in the mid 80s, and they still had a standard number you could call if you had a rotary phone. I think just building those systems and understanding that, and not just saying, all right, you're just going to go to your phone and I don't have to worry about anything else. I don't necessarily think it's a problem,
but I do think, you know, something to, like, there still needs to be a fallback. Like, let's say you don't have a smartphone, then it still needs to be like a little, like, you know, an option if you don't have a smartphone. What can you do?
Dear Abby's saying, just upgrade. Just bite the bullet. Get one. My gosh. They're not hard to find.
My gosh.
Okay. Yeah, dear Abby didn't say it that way. She was very much more polite, of course. But that, I think that's what struck me, is I expected an answer more like these from Dear Abby. And Dear Abby's like, modern world, friend.
Suck it up.
Suck it up and buy a phone.
I'm Dear Abby's tech support, so suck it up. If I had to, so can you.
Yeah. I do find it surprising, but at the same time, we have a society right now that is built around electricity and landlines. If you don't have a landline phone, there are a lot of things that are very difficult for you to do, but you can still do them. So, the basics, like I can go to the DMV and apply in person. I can do things by mail, all of that sort of thing. So if you don't have a smartphone, you can still do those same sorts of things, but it's more difficult. We have built the society to understand that most people have electricity. Most people have the ability to have a landline. And so that's the way the society is. If you're in a different part of the world, that may not work that way. In fact, in some parts of the world, mobile phones are more commonly used for things because they are more widespread than simple electricity and landlines, because they sort of leapfrogged. So I guess this is just a natural part of the evolution is where I'm going with that.
I will say, I wish that instead of just solely relying on apps, they would also have, because even though most providers or services provide a web interface to do a lot of this stuff, sometimes the functionality only exists in the app.
Yeah, where they don't like that either.
You know, and it's just like, you know, my dad would actually see this better on his 27-inch monitor than on a little tiny phone.
The worst is when you get an app that requires you to use the app only to kick you to the web. Have you ever run into that where it's like, no, you have to use the app, and then you go into the app, you do the thing, and it kicks you out to the web to finish filling it. I'm like, why couldn't you just use the web in the first place? I am looking forward to your phone being worldwide. I know that I'm skipping ahead but we're going to South Korea for our anniversary trip in a couple of days now. And knowing that we are going to want to go to a restaurant and sign up on the waiting list, we are trying to make sure we get a data plan for South Korea that includes the ability to receive and send texts.
Right.
With a, because you'll need a South Korean phone number to be on those waiting lists. Right. And I've done this in LA and I've never thought about it because I have a US phone number. Right. But you go up and they're like, oh, yeah, it'll be about 15 minutes. Just give me your phone number. I will text you when your table's available. If I want to do that in South Korea, they're not going to text my LA number. They're not going to send an international text message. They want a South Korean number. So I'm like, oh, well, if I want to do that. And I'm sure they have another way of doing it, but some people have said, yeah, it's difficult. You want to have a South Korean number, and it just makes those things even easier.
Is there like a Google Voice South Korea where they, you know, you could choose from a
I did
list
not
of
in any of my research find anything that said you could do that. What I found was your best bet is to go to one of the carriers at Incheon Airport and say, I want the plan that lets me get a South Korean number, because you have to show your passport. They have registration for eSIM. Okay. They have registration requirements. So you can't just get a Google Voice number. You have to show a person your identity. They copy it down. And then you can get one that's relatively inexpensive. In fact, it's the same price as the data only plans. They just let you top off because they charge you per text and voice call. We're not going to make that many, so we'll just buy like 5,000 won worth of service.
Yeah, I remember going to Taipei some years ago and going to the airport and getting like a I can't remember if it was a physical SIM card or eSIM, but it was basically like a carrier, and then they would just give me the SIM card, and
yeah,
it was like super easy.
Yeah,
you know
exactly. So I would love it if there was a system where it's like, oh, it doesn't really, instead of a phone number, you just have like, you know, you just tap.
Like an app.
This is me. Text me on this thing.
That's actually fairly common. This is not the same thing, obviously, but I do know that, for example, if you wanted to book Tokyo Disneyland or Tokyo Disney Sea, they want you to have a Japanese address. Like a physical Japanese address, because your credit card needs to have like a Japanese address. Mm-hmm. Otherwise they won't let you book it because you'd have a Japanese address. And so like some people, what they do is like they'll cough up the money and they'll just go stay at the Disneyland hotel, which will let you in, kind of a thing. Uh-huh. And they have to buy it like in person, like go there in person to buy the ticket. Yeah. And it's the same thing with like buying, I believe, baseball games in Japan too. It's the same thing where you can't just like use your American credit, you know, to like book it ahead of time. You have to like, they want a Japanese credit card or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's still an advancement. When I was there in the early 2000s, they took, very few places took any credit cards, even the Japan. So it was all cash or
you would think that Disneyland would want people even from not that far away, you know, Korea, China, like you'd want to make it easy for them to come. It's a short flight.
You just go in person and like,
yeah.
Oh, maybe you could use Disney bucks. Disney bucks are the new transatlantic currency.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, we looked at going to a concert in Japan, and it was a very similar thing where you have to jump through all those hoops to be able to do it. And I don't know if it was just this concert in particular, but there were no reserved seats until you showed up. You didn't pick your seat. The seats were reserved. You couldn't just sit anywhere. It wasn't general admission, but you didn't know where your seat was until you arrived. So you would arrive, show them your ticket, and then they would give you your seat assignment. It was like Southwest Airlines, but for a concert.
So a blind box assigned seating.
Blind box assigned
seating. Blind box assigned seating. All right. Yeah. All right.
I don't know if that's common or not, but that was...
I don't know either.
I mean, when I bought movie tickets in Osaka, that was all assigned seating. But they told you what you were getting when you paid them, and they gave you the ticket, had your seat number.
Yeah.
Very good.
Plus, it was paper tickets, too. Because we were looking on StubHub, we're like, oh, maybe we'll just buy, you know, third party and avoid all of the visa requirement, stuff. But it was paper tickets. And I'm like, well, I don't want to have them FedEx them all the way to America and then take them back. Forget it. We didn't end up going. Lost out. I'm sure it's
there are certain things about like the way Japan works that I found that took adjustment. And one of those was like, why isn't this automated? It's like, nah, it's sort of a social contract that certain jobs wouldn't be automated completely away in order to provide.
Yeah. I get that, though. Yeah, I understand that.
So, well, I would like to say to all the patrons, if you have something you are curious about with South Korean technology, feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. Send it in to us. I will keep my eyes out. There's a Samsung... like a store experience thingy that I might go check out. Of course, Line and KakaoTalk and all those places have stuff. I might try to go by the office of the people who thought they had done room temperature superconductivity.
Oh, hey, are you going to do any of the, or is there like a K-pop thing? Like, people, like fans do when they're in South Korea? Like, in the way that there like here many. In LA, they do.
There are very many, Roger. There is entire days worth of them, I can tell you.
So I guess my question to you, more Tom, is have you signed up for any of those or planned to do
I don't know if we have or not. There's one that you can either take a tour to get to or just go to this this hotel and then take a shuttle from the hotel. But I don't know if we've actually finished. I don't know if we may have pulled the trigger on that one or not. There's also just like, it's going to be Jungkook's birthday when we land. So all the fans will have bought billboards and signs wishing him happy birthday. So that stuff we'll just see everywhere.
Maybe they'll have a celebratory, what would be the Baskin Robbins equivalent where you could just get like his favorite flavor as the flavor of the day.
Yeah, they are Baskin Robbins brand ambassadors. So that's you're not too far off on there. Hey, look at this. Stealth Dave says, my wife and I are also celebrating our 20th wedding anniversary this week, but instead of a trip to Korea, we bought a house. Congratulations, nice. Stealth Dave. That's awesome. That is no mean feat, let me tell you. Well done. Round of applause for Stealth Dave.
Woohoo.
Saray's like, did you buy your house in Korea, Stealth Dave?
Korea.
I'm going to guess not. Stealth Dave's like, no, that might have been cheaper. Our house is in the LA area. Even bigger difficulty level.
Significantly.
Yeah, Roger and I know. Not San Francisco and New York, I think, are the worst still. Mainland-wise.
No, I think LA recently bypassed San Francisco.
Oh, really? Did it?
But by like,
probably only in certain regions, though.
Yeah. I think San Francisco, I think like maybe the... I don't know. I'm not entirely sure this is correct, but I think sort of the surrounding areas are more expensive now, like Atherton.
Yes, my sister lives immediately south of the San Francisco border, so you know what city I'm talking about. But her house price dropped like by 0.19%.
So, really? Oh, well, there you go.
Wow. Yeah, they're definitely not dropping in LA. I'll say that. Yeah, Ryan.
I mean, it's dropping, but it's still over $1 million. Yeah. So you know.
Listen, it's all context, right?
You know? Right.
If you're
instead
losing
of one and
million,
a half million, that two bedroom house is only 1.3 million.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
if I told you I lost $2 million, but then told you I was worth $35 billion, you know, suddenly your sympathy
I'm less sympathetic. Yeah, express your loss as percentage, please. Oh man,
$6 billion.
Yeah. Well, folks, thank you for being with us. Thanks for hanging out with us. We are at your leisure, whether we exist or not, as people. if we don't have enough patrons, Roger and I just poof, we stop. We stop existing. We were never here. So please convince more people to become our patrons. And thanks to Ryan, who gave us a raise on the monthly. That's very, very much appreciated. Kriya Artem also gave us a yearly raise. Thank you as well. Thanks, everybody who supports us on Patreon, which is those of you listening right now. We also do a live video stream. If you haven't checked that out, twitch.tv/gooddayinternet. We have folks who can support us there without even spending any extra money. If they're an Amazon Prime subscriber, they can apply their Amazon Prime subscription to one Twitch channel a month, and many of them apply it to us, which is very nice because it doesn't cost them anything extra, and we get some money out of it. So thank you, Possum42, for doing that for the 36th month. Dr. Nixon for the 38th month. Says thank you for 38 months of good days, dedicating this one to Android Faithful. Ah, thank you, Dr. Nixon. Zoe brings bacon, cheered us with some bits. So did Brian M64 and Technomensch. Brian M64 has been with us for 25 months. Free money. Keep up the great job. Psycho Motors resubscribed with Prime for the 42nd month. We also just got some follows. Always good to have followers. Noxtron, FefZero, Endless Tracks. Lord Itchy 73 resubscribed for the 48th month. Thanks to every single one of you. And thank you, Nicole. Always good hanging out with you.
Thanks for having me.
Until tomorrow, everyone. If you can, I hope you can have a good day.
Have a good day.
Have a good day.
Good day, Internet.